it could be like an artwork. You start looking at these images of the enteric nervous system, and it's just like, I don't know how you can't be hooked on that.
Have you ever heard someone call the gut the second brain? That's because there are hundreds of millions of neurons that line the walls of the gut. Dr. Brian Goldbranson joins us today on the Gastronauts podcast to tell us about the structure and function of these neurons and supporting cells called the enteric nervous system. Dr. Goldbranson earned his PhD at the University of Colorado Denver and did his postdoctoral fellowship at the University of Calgary. He is now an associate professor of physiology in the neuroscience program at Michigan State University, where he specializes in how the enteric nervous system responds to inflammation. Please welcome Dr. Goldbranson to the Gastronauts podcast. Well, Dr. Goldbranson, thanks for joining us today and welcome to the Gastronauts podcast.
Yeah, well, thanks for the opportunity to join. And
just taking a 10,000 foot view for our audience who may not be so familiar with the enteric nervous system, Can you tell us what is the enteric nervous system? What are glia, and how in the world is it that glia and neurons talk to each other?
So for everybody listening, the enteric nervous system is the most important part of the nervous system, of course, and it's absolutely the most interesting and important component of the nervous system. But that being said, so the enteric nervous system is really interesting because it's the most expansive and diverse component of the autonomic nervous system, and it lines your digestive tract. So these are neurons and glia that live in the walls of your digestive tract and control most of your ongoing gut functions. And so these are all things that are happening out of your conscious control. They're ongoing every moment of the day, right? And so these are things controlling digestion and motility and secretion and interactions with the immune system and all these complicated things in the gut. But the enteric nervous system has all the circuitry to do this all on its own without necessarily talking to the brain to get second commands to be able to do this. Because it's complicated and it's large and expansive nervous system, it's been known as the second brain, or the brain in the gut. The big brain and the brain in the spinal cord is composed of neurons and then another cell type called glia. And glia encompass actually multiple cell types. So in the brain, these are things like astrocytes, oligodendrocytes, and microglia. And these are support cells for the neurons. And so they do different things. And so oligodendrocytes kind of insulate neural processes and help with conduction down these electrical wires, basically. The microglia are like immune cells. And then the astrocytes are cells that modify signaling and support neurons. And so the enteric glia are actually, they kind of display characteristics of all these different types of glia. And so they're a unique type of peripheral glia that are the partners of enteric neurons in the gut. And so they live with the enteric neurons, and so they're in these collections of neuron cell bodies called ganglia. And within these basically like sacks of neurons, you have neurons and glia. And the glia surround the neurons, and they signal back and forth to each other. And so the neurons activate the glia when they're signaling. They tell the glia, you know, hey, I'm signaling in this pathway. And then the glia can talk back and kind of tune the signaling in these pathways, and they can provide support to the neurons to help sustain synaptic signaling. They can protect the neurons so they can elicit different responses to inflammation or different challenges. And a lot of these things are meant at protecting responses. And basically the big thing that they're doing is thought to maintain homeostasis, or kind of maintain the status quo in these enteric neural networks. And whether they do this by eliciting inflammatory responses or just tuning synaptic signaling kind of depends on the context. But it seems like they actually do a lot of things. They're very flexible cells, so they can adapt to different conditions easily and change their phenotype. So they're an interesting cell type to study because they're so involved in homeostasis. They're actually involved in most of the digestive disorders or diseases of the gut that we'd be interested in studying and knowing the mechanisms of how these things work.
What are some of the disorders that we know that the enteric nervous system and these glia are involved in?
So two of the big ones are irritable bowel syndrome and inflammatory bowel disease. So both of those actually have some sort of a inflammatory component in some way. And acute inflammation in the gut can cause neuroplasticity in these networks. And so basically that's just a change induced by inflammation. And so these networks can be temporarily or permanently altered by experiencing a history of inflammation. And then that can cause changes in how the intrinsic neural networks of the gut function. So you can get these changes in motor function. And then you can also change how they interact with the neurons that innervate the gut from the spinal cord. And these are pathways that influence sensations like pain. And so one of the big problems that people have related to their gut is actually it's visceral pain. And so they have some sensation of like painful feelings in their gut. And these are often caused by having some kind of history of inflammation. And it's changing the sensitivity of these nerve fibers that innervate the gut. And some of the mechanisms that cause those sensory neurons to become changed in how they convey information from the gut back to the brain and spinal cord is how they interact with the glia. And the glia are actually changing the sensitivity of these nerve fibers in the gut.
And you've done some work on looking at particular targets that we can use to modulate the signaling and disrupt the signaling that we know happens in these visceral hypersensitivity and pain states. Can you tell us a little bit about what you've found?
So we've been interested in several different mechanisms and pathways. The pathways probably depend on the context. And so a lot of this depends on the nature of the insult, the sex of the individual, and the particular organ that you're interested in. So the specific mechanisms change from context to context. Some of the big ones that we've been interested in are purines that are released from glia. So these are a signaling molecule that are released through these membrane channels on the glia. And these are things that can be released during inflammation, and they can contribute to inflammation, or they can act as just cell signaling molecules. And so we've been interested in this class of compounds called purines as a mediator of cell signaling between glia and other things. Another one that we've been interested in now are prostaglandins. Prostaglandins and some of the other lipid mediators in the enteric nervous system, like endocannabinoids, actually seem like big regulators of how these visceral afferent neurons are sensitized or desensitized, I guess. So the glia regulate both things, so they can produce prostaglandins, and these are things that kind of turn up the sensitivity of the DRG neurons that innervate the gut, and so they can increase pain. And then the glia also control how much endocannabinoids there are, and so these are things that can decrease pain. And so if you have more endocannabinoids, that's actually dampening the activity of these sensory neurons innervating the gut. So glia can both, you know, be involved with increasing and decreasing pain by how much of these two compounds they're producing.
And what do we know about sex specificity?
The sex specificity as it relates to disorders like IBS is pretty clear. And IBS has historically been known as a female predominant disorder of gut-brain interaction. It's actually, if you look globally, the stats are it's slightly more prevalent in females, but it depends on the context. So it seems like in females, having a history of acute inflammation or having a history of childhood abuse seems to make females more susceptible to irritable bowel syndrome. In males, it seems like it's different. And so males also are, you know, almost half of the people that are affected by irritable bowel syndrome. It's slightly less than females, but there are a lot of males affected by irritable bowel syndrome too. Males are affected by inflammation, but it seems like males are more affected by early life neglect. And so there's some different contexts in how the mechanisms that play into this and what makes males susceptible to irritable bowel syndrome versus females. So we've got some ongoing work looking at sex differences in the glia in the gut and how they might actually contribute to differences in visceral hypersensitivity or motility disorders. And it seems like the glia actually are involved in sex differences in how the visceral afferent nerves become sensitized to inflammation. And they're involved in differences in mechanisms that control things like endocannabinoids in the gut. There's sex differences just in overall in gene profiles in the glia too. So there are differences in how the glia respond to mediators from neurons between males and females. And it seems like female glia at baseline seems like they're more excitable than male glia. Whether or not that's a good thing or a bad thing, we don't really know yet. But there are these sex differences are going to be interesting things in the future to dig in deeper.
Definitely. And it seems like a lot of this context specificity then is based on experiences that people have had. What do we know about how these enteric glia are communicating with the central nervous system, the ascending and descending inputs to the brain, and how those are involved in this regulation?
That's a great question. So there's crosstalk between the glia and these sensory neurons that innervate the gut from dorsal root ganglia. There's some crosstalk between the glia and sympathetic neurons that innervate the gut. At least sympathetic neurons can activate glia. Whether or not there's ongoing signaling between other branches of the nervous system that might innervate the gut is unknown. There's some evidence that there may be some crosstalk with vagal neurons that innervate the gut. How glia might change information that then goes back to the brain is something that's going to be interesting to get into because that's not known. And, you know, whether glia could be signaling back to the brain by influencing vagal afferent neurons, like that's an interesting question to get after, right? And how they might, you know, change processing in the brain to influence like motivation cues or different states of digestion or something. Nobody knows.
One of the other things that really stood out to me, in our lab, we do a lot of work on the gut and its sensory capacity for sensing dietary nutrients. And we know that really the gut is the biggest endocrine organ because it releases hormones after we sense these nutrients. One of the hormones it releases is CCK. Mm-hmm. And I know CCK can be used to activate these enteric glia. What do we know about how our diet influences activity of glia in the enteric nervous system?
I don't know if there's any... If there's a lot of information about what happens with the diet, I think one thing I can tell you about the diet, one of the mechanisms that we've gotten interested in over the past couple of years is this biolipid called lysophosphatidic acid. It's a component of like dark green leafy vegetables. Mm-hmm. So things like broccoli has a lot of LPA in it, and some, like, I think spinach does too. This stuff is made by plants. It's made by cells. It can come from lots of different sources, but one of the sources is actually dietary plants, right? And if you look at G protein coupled receptors, so these are membrane receptors expressed by the glia, the highest expression levels are actually a receptor for this lysophosphatidic acid. And so they're really sensitive to this stuff. And so if you eat more of these green leafy vegetables, that's going to be, you know, stimulating your glia in some way. If that's good or bad, we don't know. It seems like, you know, having this signaling through the lysophosphatidic acid receptors is important because if you block these things, systemically anyway, in animals anyway, it kills them. So you have to have some signaling going on. We think it may be actually an important migration cue for these cells or something like a important cell survival cue. You know, these things that are eating in your diet could affect the activity or maturation of these cells in the enteric nervous system.
And you recently published a paper just last year about what we know about some of the differences between populations of enteric glia and different parts of the intestine and different layers of the intestinal wall. What does doing that kind of analysis help us with moving forward in the field?
So I think that kind of analysis is important because, you know, historically we've kind of looked at the enteric glia as just a uniform population of cells, and that a glial cell is a glial cell is a glial cell, right? And it doesn't seem like that really fits with the idea of specificity in synaptic circuits. Like, these cells have to be somewhat different from each other, right, to act in some specific way, because you can't have a cell interacting with a neuron in the same way if that, you know, neuron is different, right, than its neighbor. So those cells have to be different in some way. And we know that there's different populations of these glial cells that are with either the neuron cell bodies or with neuron processes in all the different layers of the gut wall. So some of these cells are living out by the mucosa, so they're closer to the lumen of the intestine. Some of them are in the muscle. And then some of them sit with the neuron cell bodies and the nerve plexus. So understanding like what these cells do in their different environments is important because since they're so plastic, their functions are probably very different in these different environments. And what they're doing, how they're interacting with their neighbors is probably going to be different depending on where you are in the gut and where you are through the gut wall itself. So even within the nerve plexus that controls gut motor function, the glial cells in these pathways are actually different from their neighbors. And so they're associated with specific synaptic pathways that run next to each other through these enteric ganglia. So some of these cells seem like they're specifically activated by different circuits. And so, you know, you might have two glia sitting close to each other, but activating those glia is only going to happen under certain circumstances when those synaptic pathways are active. And then the transmitters that activate these glia seem like they're different depending on where you are in the gut too. So I think the paper that you're referring to, we were looking at differences in how the glia respond to things like purines and CCK in the duodenum and the colon. And it's interesting because you would think that if these cells are just kind of doing the same thing wherever they are in the gut, they would respond in similar ways, and they don't. And what we found is actually that there's differences that kind of match what the function of the organ would be. So CCK signaling seems like it's more important to glia in the duodenum, where you've got more CCK signaling normally happening. And then ATP signaling seems like it's more important to signaling for glia in the colon, where purinergic signaling might be more prominent. So those types of things are kind of important if we think about, like, if we wanted to manipulate these cells to improve digestive health, you'd have to target certain populations of these cells to do it. Like if you just had a therapy that was going to hit all of the glia the same way, might not do that much good, because, you know, you might have opposing actions, you know, in these different gut regions that might actually give you some kind of negative outcome rather than a positive outcome. So I think if we understand the specifics of what the different cells do, that makes it a lot easier in the future to kind of envision how we might tune these cells to improve gut function.
And how is it preclinically that you're able to target those specific populations of neurons? What tools do we have?
So some of the tools that we're using right now are, we use this technique called chemogenetics. And so this is basically expressing a foreign receptor in these cells that's activated by a biologically inert drug. And so we can express these receptors in glia, and then we can basically like squirt on this synthetic drug that just activates the glia that we want. And then we can activate those cells and study the outcomes on the neural network. Other tools where we might be able to start targeting the specific subpopulations of glia aren't available yet. And so those are things that we're going to have to dig in deeper and understand, you know, what actually makes these cells different in these different areas to develop tools to actually target them. And so that information is kind of starting to become available with some of the single cell sequencing data that's coming out now. And you can see some differences in populations of cells starting to emerge from that. Whether or not those are actually going to be important functional differences, nobody knows yet. But at least it's like a start of where we could go, I think.
Are you personally interested in developing those types of tools, or is that somewhere that you look to collaborate?
I would definitely be interested in developing those sorts of tools to be able to target specific subpopulations of cells. That's something that we've kind of been interested in, and looking at markers of different populations of cells, you know, ways we could isolate different types of glia, you know, if there's a way we can identify them with cell surface markers or something, you know, to be able to characterize these cells better. I think that's probably going to be an important direction for the field to move into if we ever want to really understand what the different populations of the glia are doing. Mm-hmm. Whether it's possible or not, I don't know, because the cells are very plastic. And so it's hard to say if, you know, cell A in this environment can't turn into cell B if we put it in the same environment, right? And so they're very influenced by their surroundings. And so it's hard to say if the phenotype of these cells is really fixed or not.
And one thing I would imagine that would be important in developing these types of specific tools moving forward is the type of model system that you're using. That's always a struggle in science, figuring out what the best model system is for the tool you need to use, what's going to end up being the most translatable. So what model system do you use, and why do you feel that that is the best for the type of research that you do?
So most of the model systems that we use, it's preclinical rodent models, right? And so most of these, you know, every model system has its challenges, and it's kind of, you know, it has its positives and negatives, right? And they're never a perfect model of something. That's why it's a model, right? The best is, of course, if you can study it in humans, but that's usually not possible with the same types of techniques that you want to be able to use to get down into cellular mechanisms, right? So there has to be some kind of compromise where you can study these things in a tractable system, but that also gives you the technological abilities to do what you want, right? So some of the models that we use are models of acute inflammation. And so those are things that are known to drive neuroplasticity. And that's like what we were talking about earlier related to the pathophysiology of developing things like irritable bowel syndrome, and then these long changes in inflammatory bowel disease that persist after a resolution of the active inflammation. Mm-hmm. So we use these acute colitis models to trigger inflammation. And then once that resolves, there's neuroplasticity in these networks, and we can study how glia contribute to the changes that are induced. Another one of the models is an early life stress model. And so this is involved in some of these susceptibility factors to developing irritable bowel syndrome. And so experiencing early life adversity is known as is one of the mechanisms that predisposes people to being susceptible to developing IBS. And so we use a model with neonatal maternal separation. And so it's basically like, it's basically the daycare model where you take the pups away from a mom for 3 hours a day and then you wean them a couple days early. But this causes long-term changes in gut health. And so it's an interesting thing to think about if we extrapolate that to humans and how the human healthcare system is set up with, you know, moms being forced to go back to work early and kids going in the daycare early. And if you think about, you know, the long-term consequences of that system on gut health. Mm-hmm. And so that those are two of the main model systems that we use are these acute inflammations and then psychological stress during a critical period in development.
Do you see that there are differences between the acute phase of the stressor and then the more chronic, you know, after effects in terms of the enteric glia and what their role is in inflammation?
It's a good question. We haven't looked as much into the acute stressor phase. Mm-hmm. We've done a little bit of that with mature animals and looking at, you know, in the mature system during stress, you get an activation of the sympathetic innervation of the enteric nervous system, and the sympathetics crosstalk with the enteric glia and can activate those cells. During this early life adversity, that's a different type of stress because it's doesn't seem to be this acute stressor thing where you get the sympathetic activation. So that seems like it's involving different mechanisms. And it's probably a little bit more complicated where it's involving these central pathways and a lot of other changes to the system, right? It involves these immune changes, some changes where you get this stress hyporesponsive period and things. So there's a lot of changes in development and just how the whole wiring is set up with that model. So we haven't looked at what's actually happening in the signaling like during that critical phase. We've been interested in kind of the longer term effects of experiencing that, because we've been thinking of, you know, if we're going to translate this to humans, where would it be relevant, right? And if you have somebody that has irritable bowel syndrome, you know, most of the time you can't go back in time and kind of reset it and kind of correct whatever happened, because whatever happened has happened. And you have to think of, like, once it's happened, how do we fix it?
And it always seems like going from rodent models to humans, there are some signaling pathways, some receptors, some signaling molecules that are more analogous in rodents to humans than others. Is that a prerequisite when you decide, oh, I'm going to focus on looking at what this receptor is doing in signaling or what this signaling molecule is doing in signaling? Are you looking ahead to the humans before you decide to investigate it further in the rodent models?
Usually we try to look at some kind of translational significance, right? And one of the pathways that I was mentioning earlier, this lysophosphatidic acid, mm-hmm. That was one where we did that. And we were using some human samples from this disorder called intestinal pseudo-obstruction. And so these people have an obstruction in the gut with no mechanical cause, it seems like. So there's this, it's called a pseudo-obstruction because there's no kind of overt reason why there should be an obstruction in the gut. And so we were looking at samples of human enteric nervous system from these people and looking at glial lysophosphatidic acid receptor. And the humans express this receptor on glia just like animals do, just like rodents do. And it seems like it's the same type of receptor distribution. And if you lose the receptor in humans, that's associated with this chronic intestinal pseudo-obstruction phenotype you see. And so we think that this actually seems like an important conserved mechanism all the way from, you know, mice to people. And that if you screw it up, it's not good, right? And so it seems like it's probably an important one to study.
Yeah.
How do you envision then going forward from the field that's studying glia and the enteric nervous system to coming up with treatments for IBS for humans? How do you see that pathway playing out?
Well, I think one of the challenges that we have to address before we can do that is figuring out how we would specifically target enteric glia. That's been a challenge up to this point of like, how do we get drugs into these cells? How do we affect the cells that we want? And how do we not mess up a glial function that's actually going to be protective? Mm-hmm. Because most of the things that the glia are doing are these protective responses, whether it's during inflammation or after inflammation. You may have some maladaptive responses of the glia that can be changed then to kind of improve gut health. And that's kind of where we're fitting in right now, is just trying to understand like what's a beneficial change of the glia and what's a maladaptive change of the glia. Mm-hmm. And how do we figure out, you know, what's good, what's bad, and when you would target one versus the other, right? There are some things that would be easier to manipulate. One of the systems that we've been studying at the moment is the endocannabinoid system. Mm-hmm. And so the endocannabinoid system is really important in the gut, and it's involved in overall gut health and functions. But it seems like the endocannabinoid system is also involved in disease. And so if you change how the glia regulate endocannabinoid signaling in the gut, you know, you could probably tune different functions, you know. And I think there's still a long way to go in understanding exactly how the glia do this and what they're doing before you could actually, you know, propose to actually target one of these things and manipulate it in disease. And then, like I was saying, we'd want to know where we'd want to target it and what type of glia we'd want to target too, because there's a lot of overlap between these glia and, you know, other types of glia in the peripheral nervous system. There's other types of glia in the central nervous system that display characteristics like these cells. And you wouldn't want to have a drug or something that affects all these glia in the same way, because that wouldn't do any good probably.
Yeah, definitely. So I asked about sort of the sensor versus the signaling molecule and looking at how that relates to the disease in humans. How do you decide just based on which part of the signaling cascade is sort of going to be the most therapeutic or maybe is going to give you the most specificity for a particular population of glia?
You know, we've been focused on some of the basic kind of mechanisms like what's activating the cell and then what the release mechanism is for stuff coming out of the cell, basically. Mm-hmm. But all the things between those two points are kind of a black box in a lot of ways, right? And some of those things actually might be kind of the key to understanding the points to manipulate in different cells. That the challenge is, you know, a lot of the signaling components that would be between those two points in the cell are shared by like every other cell, right? And so there wouldn't be a lot of specificity if you targeted like, you know, GPCR downstream components or something in glia versus, you know, other types of cells in the gut. If you had a drug that for some reason only got into glia and could affect those cells, then yes, maybe that would be like the way to go. But, you know, at the moment, like we've really been focused on like the receptor and then the release mechanism, because those seem like those are important points where we could either stimulate the cells or change how they release things that signal to neurons or immune cells or things.
Mm-hmm. So if money were no object and you were able to get all the tools that you wanted, what would be your dream discovery?
Oh, man, what would be my dream discovery? I think, you know, putting together a complete circuit of how the enteric nervous system works with the glia, how they interact with each neuron type in the gut and how they're involved in some of these complicated motor patterns like the colonic migrating motor complex, mm-hmm. or those types of things, and how the glia integrate in this system with the different cell types. And I think just developing like a comprehensive model of how this actually works would be really beneficial, because I think right now we're still kind of stuck with this model in the field of kind of, you know, in a way, sort of this archaic reflex that looks like the spinal reflex arc with this sensory neuron that synapses onto interneurons that go up and down the gut that synapse onto motor neurons. But we know that that's like a way oversimplification of how the network works. And the enteric nervous system also has these forms of activity that don't require any sensory input. And they have these like this central pattern generator types of activity that are just generated by the network itself. And so how these things are actually initiated is not known still. This is kind of crazy. And so like, I think that the glia are probably involved in triggering these things, or, you know, the integration in these forms of activity that would be just spontaneous enteric nervous system patterns. And I think that understanding how the glia are involved in that type of activity and how they, you know, signal with the neurons and propagate these, propagate kind of different types of ongoing patterns of the gut would be great. Love to know that.
Yeah, that would be very, very interesting to be able to, you know, have that exactly mapped out, to know exactly the directionality of what, you know, the manipulation would need to be therapeutic for the different types of functions of the ENS.
Well, I think, you know, because a comparable understanding of even the neurons in the gut isn't there. Mm-hmm. So we still, you know, as much as we know about the different types of neurons that are in the gut and their individual properties with electrophysiology, mm-hmm. how the system works as a network is still not very well defined. And so, you know, so understanding that is a challenge in itself, but then layering on how the glia are involved in that network, I think is even a bigger challenge, right? Yeah.
Why do you think it's taken the field so long to get from the point where we want to do all of this neuron and glial specific mapping in the brain and getting everybody to move down to want to do that in the gut? What do you think has been the holdup?
I still don't know if everybody wants to move down and work in the gut.
Yeah.
It's great, because I think that a lot of the holdup is just a lot of people aren't familiar with it, you know, and you tell people about the enteric nervous system, and I'm still surprised when people are kind of blown away by the idea of there's actually, you know, neurons that live in the wall of the gut, and you have this huge, you know, population of peripheral neurons, like the largest population of neurons outside the brain and spinal cord lives in the gut wall, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like by magnitude in humans, it's like the size of a cat brain, right? So you've got like hundreds of millions of neurons in the walls of the gut. And so you tell people that, and a lot of people are kind of like, I never knew that. You know, we were never taught that in our neuroscience classes, never heard of it before. And so I think just kind of like introducing people to the concept of the enteric nervous system is important. And I think that's been one of the hurdles. I think another one of the hurdles is like, in a way, like the gut just isn't as sexy as the brain, you know? And you tell people like you work with the gut, and it's like, you work with poop. Mm-hmm. And it's like, yes and no, right? But like the enteric nervous system is actually really cool, and it does all these things that are directly involved in really important human diseases, right? So these are things that affect like a quarter of humans worldwide, right? It's not like a fraction of a percentage of people, right? So these are like big problems where you have enteric nervous system disruptions. So I think there's kind of the perception of like people don't want to work in the gut because they view it as like, you know, not as cool in a way. There's also the lack of information thing, I think, that's been kind of a hurdle. And then traditionally, like, gut research has been dominated by the clinical world. Mm-hmm. And I think the clinical side of things kind of, it's harder for basic scientists to kind of get involved with that sometimes, you know, in that field. It's not like the central neuroscience world. It's very basic science dominated, I think.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned when you were first getting interested in science, you were walking down the hallway, saw the poster that said gut on it, and you were very excited automatically. Mm-hmm. But that seems not to be everyone's response. How do you cultivate that level of excitement in your trainees, even at the undergraduate level where you're bringing them in for the first time to this world of research?
So I actually teach a class on autonomic neuroscience for undergraduates. And, you know, a lot of them actually say that the enteric neuroscience part of that class was their favorite part, because they were just like, they'd never heard of it before, and it was actually a cool system, and they were excited to learn about it. I think a lot of people that come into the lab, once they actually start looking at the enteric nervous system, and like you do an experiment and you do some labeling in the enteric nervous system and you look at it under a microscope and you're hooked. Like, it's just beautiful, right? And like every immuno experiment that you do and do some labeling, you do some fluorescence microscopy, like it could be like an artwork or something, right? And you just look at the stuff and it's just like amazing. And so I think like you start looking at these images of the enteric nervous system and it's just like, I don't know how you can't be hooked on that, right? And it's just such a beautiful system, and it's, you can take it out and you can do so many things with it, right? And in the brain, one of the challenges that you have in the brain, if you're looking at behavior, right, is that you're looking at these complex things that involve, you're looking at an output that's like miles away, basically, in terms of synaptic signaling, right? And changing all these like motor behaviors and things. So if you're looking at, you know, something that controls a leg movement or something, you might have something in the brain that synapses on many different types of neurons that eventually lead down to the motor pattern in the hind paw or something, right? In the enteric nervous system, you've got the organ and the neurons right there, right? So you've got the neural network, you've got the end organ all in the same dish, if you want to study it. And so you can do some really cool stuff with that and look at the whole integration of the system. So I think, you know, once people kind of see the opportunities, see what the system looks like, most people kind of come in, I think a lot of people are kind of skeptical and they're like, I don't know if I want to work in the gut. And then they actually start doing it and they're like, this is so cool. Can't imagine doing something else, you know? And so I think that's, it's always really fun to see too. It's fun to see people be like, get hooked on enteric neuroscience when they do it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think, you know, somebody said one time that like every enteric neuroscientist is born with a chip on their shoulder. And you kind of see that develop in people too, where they're kind of like, they're automatically irritated if central nervous system people don't respect the enteric nervous system, you know, mm-hmm. and get very defensive about it too, because it's like, it's their system now. And it's very cool.
It seems like you're obviously very excited about the ENS. I would imagine your trainees are very excited about the ENS. But as you mentioned, there's so much that we don't know about it. How do you help your trainees from your mentorship role navigate that uncertainty and figure out where they're going to carve their path in the field?
Well, I think a lot of it's like, go after low-hanging fruit, mm-hmm. right? So answer the questions that need to be answered, right? And those kind of lead into your own path eventually. You know, and a lot of that kind of like, you kind of have to follow the data where the data go. And, you know, usually the projects kind of develop their own paths and lead in a different direction that we never anticipated going in the first place. And so a lot of the times it kind of naturally carves out their own thing as that develops. But I think, you know, another thing to think about too is, so there's a lot of expertise out there in the world now in, you know, neuroscience, immunology, other fields, right? And starting to combine those in with how the enteric nervous system works is going to be really important. So there's this whole emerging area now of gut immune system, you know, enteric nervous system, immune system interactions. So neuroimmune interactions in the gut. That is a huge area for development. And there are so many unknowns there about how the enteric nervous system might interact with immune cells and modulate gut immune functions. Because, like, I'm sure you guys know that the gut's also not only the largest endocrine organ, it's also the largest immune organ in the body, right? So how the nervous system tunes the immune responses in the gut's really important. And that's, you know, so looking at these areas like that about, like, you know, hey, this is a big area where, you know, there's a lot of room to expand in this area. Just go after it, right?
Yeah. And how do you make the decision as someone that kind of sits at the nexus of neuroscience, cell biology, immunology, about what you're going to go after personally and what is better served as a collaboration?
I think that's, you know, one of the things you always have to try to do is, like, focus on, like, what you can do and, like, know where your strengths and weaknesses are, mm-hmm. you know? And I know, like, what we can do in my lab and, like, what we're good at doing. And I know what we're not good at doing, too. So I am, you know, I am not a molecular biologist. I am not a biochemist. I am not a microbiome person, right? So it's like, and I know that I am not an immunologist. So it's like, you know, I know all those things we would need help with, you know, so things that deal with like neurons and glia and how they signal with each other and some imaging stuff, like that's kind of our bread and butter of what we do. And so that's stuff that like very comfortable doing in our lab. Other stuff where it's, I know we're getting outside of our expertise. Like if we wanted to do anything with like the microbiome or something, it's really complicated. And I know that like, I don't have the expertise to lead that because it's just way more complicated than I would know. So those types of things, like it's pretty clear we'd need a collaborator.
Yeah. And what do you find are the best venues and ways to go about setting up those collaborations?
I think a lot of the collaboration just depends on personalities meshing and common interests, you know, and some of that just kind of develops naturally, I think, you know, and so some people you just kind of naturally have a good relationship with, and these things kind of develop organically, you know, and even if it's not stuff that's like kind of a natural fit together, like you'll start collaborating with somebody just because like you talk to them all the time and it's like, hey, we should actually do this, you know, and those things are like easy to do then too. Other things, you know, if you know you need help in a specific area, it's finding somebody who's a good scientist who you trust, who's going to interact well with you, you know, and who you can see like working well with, I think, you know, and trying to set that up that way. Other types of collaborations that we have too is like, you know, on the clinical side of things. Mm-hmm. So if we need human tissues or we're looking for people that work with humans, right? And so since we don't have humans as a component of my research program at Michigan State, like we have to go outside that to find people that have a clinical research program where we could get like human samples and we could have the translational aspect to add, you know, add some impact to the work.
Definitely all good things to keep in mind, especially for me as an early stage trainee trying to figure out how to build those collaborations as I go forward. One last question for you. Day in, day out, you go into lab, you're doing this work in a system that is, as you've mentioned, vast and very difficult to understand. There are a lot of successes in science. There are also a lot of failures in science. What keeps you the most energized and excited to go into lab every day and do this day in, day out?
That's a good question. I mean, I think you just have to really like doing it, you know, and it has to be, I mean, it would be very easy to get discouraged, you know, because like you're saying, like there's ups and downs for sure. And you have successes and there's a lot of failures and you have to like celebrate the small successes and take time to enjoy those things because there's always going to be like a million things that are failures too. And you can't let the failures, you can't dwell on those things and let them kind of dominate your thinking. Like you have to kind of just move on, like take what positive things you can get from it and then move on to the next thing. If we try something out in the lab, you know, and it doesn't work and it's like, you know, some crazy idea or something, we try it out, give it a shot, it doesn't work. Most of the time we're not going to dwell on it, right? We're going to move on because like you said, there's a lot of other things to focus on and there's no point like banging your head against the wall, you know, if something's not going to work. I think the idea of kind of making discoveries is really cool. And I think it's kind of like there's not that many opportunities in the world right now to kind of be like an explorer and find something new. And I've always been kind of drawn to the idea of like exploration, you know, and like finding new things. And like I've always been kind of into like adventure sports and like exploring new spots and things like that. And there's not really, you know, parts of the world that are really that unknown anymore. But in science, we have the opportunity to kind of be like explorers, you know, and discover new things. And so I think the idea of you can be the first person that understands this happening is really cool. Mm-hmm. And like, you can be the first person that sees something happen for the first time, right? I think that's really neat. They're really exciting.
Always an exciting moment. Great advice. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. And I've really enjoyed the opportunity getting to chat with you.
Yeah, well, thanks for the opportunity. This was great.
Of course. While the enteric nervous system is vast, Dr. Gulbranson's work is helping to push us towards a better understanding of how we can manipulate communication in the gut to alter immune responses. Understanding how glial cells interact with neurons and other cell types in the gut could lead to insights for treating irritable bowel syndrome, inflammatory bowel disease, and other digestive disorders. These cell-cell interactions have been investigated in the brain for decades, but it may be the second brain that is critical to understanding how the nervous system coordinates disease responses.